It says, watershed high water marks in honor of Bud Trout and in memory of G.C. Trout II and L.W. Robinson. Words by G.C. Trout IV. Photography by Dwayne Bratcher. Originally published in Delta Magazine, Volume 18, Number 1, July and August of 2020. Memory believes before knowing remembers, believes longer than recollects, longer than knowing even wonders. William Faulkner. Among myriad methods for landed largemouth bass, the nonpareils of fly fishing persist. The cast, the strike, the fight. There are few endeavors in this life offering greater satisfaction than netting a warm water carnivore of, say, 5 pounds on a flimsy 5-weight fly rod. The strike is a shock, a thrill. It's a fight to which you're barely equal, a joy unsurpassed in success. I've been fishing the watershed lakes in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, since I was a child. From then until now, I've haunted the waters of Hubbard Murphy Drainage District, lakes carrying such names as Riles Wren, Lowry's, and Poorhouse. Poorhouse, where I have vivid memories of fishing as a child with my brother on one half of the front boat seat while I sat on the other as our father motored us across lily-strewn waters towards a fishless day. We were alone aside from a local coach who showed us a tremendous stringer full of bass and crappie. He was rumored to be mostly Choctaw. I recall the way the light worked on his red and ruddy skin, cerise in the boozy and florid light of sundown. An hour later, we returned home with nothing save the memory of a happy day spent with my father and my brother. In these lakes live leviathans, though. Lately, I know of a 12.5 and a 13.5 pound bass caught out of them, and more 7 to 9 pound bass than we can record. But at some point, the numbers become superfluous. Fishing is about catching fish, yes, but it's mostly about unwinding, spending time with loved ones, problem solving. As Mississippi writer Barry Hanna once noted, there's nothing more contemplative than a body of water. Located high in the Loess Bluffs that skirt its eastern edge, watershed lakes provide a vital service to the Delta. There are possibly hundreds of these lakes throughout a 30 or so such districts. Hubbard Murphy was organized in the late 1950s by my grandfather, G.C. Trout, and two other landowners, A.A. Mabus and N.C. Shook, who saw the need for more localized control of the flooding that plagued their farms. The primary result is thousands of acres of land with improved drainage and reduced flooding. This led to farmable and inhabitable land where it didn't previously exist. The greatest collateral benefit is they tend to be terrifyingly fine fishing lakes. The fact that my paternal grandfather, who passed away when I was a baby, was not only a founder and the first president of this drainage district, but also enough of a fly fisherman to own a nice split-cane bamboo fly rod my father allows me to use occasionally, makes the connection all the more special. I learned to fish from my father, Bud Trout, and my maternal grandfather, L.W. Robinson, a man who taught me much in the 16 years I knew him. Three things come to mind regarding who he was and his philosophy. I once asked him what he was, where his people came from. He replied, "I'm Dutch, Irish, and devil's son," and he left it at that. Another time, as we drove by a golf course, he half snorted, half chuckled, "Golf. That's what people do when they get too old to fish. I want to live a good long life, but I don't want to live so long I have to take up golf." Later in his life, when I was 15, he told me, "You should get up every morning and watch the sunrise. No two are the same, and every one is beautiful. You never know which one will be the start of your last day on this earth." 2 years ago, the doctor gave me 6 months to live. He trailed off at that, staring into the sun. I like to think he was ruminating on a perfect day on a nearby lake with his wife, Mary Agnes, hauling in crappie. One of my earliest memories is fishing with him and my brother, Daniel, in a lake near Teesdale. I remember catching two catfish before Granddaddy baited his hook. I was certain I was going to outfish him, but I didn't then, nor did I ever. I don't believe Granddaddy knew how to fly fish, but he taught me the finer nuances of catching crappie, bream, and catfish with livers, worms, and crickets. This angling craft is indispensable. In some ways, it's like learning scales in music, or perhaps heart and soul compared to fly fishing's Fifth Symphony. Or maybe, more simply, if you're looking to put fish in a skillet, Granddaddy's method works every time. My parents gave me a 5/6 weight L.L. Bean fly rod for my 16th birthday, about 2 weeks before Granddaddy passed away. It came with a reel, line, and a small piece of scarlet yarn tied to the end of the leader. My heart flickered. I looked at it with all the curiosity and excitement of an ancient man first beholding a red and blazing flame. Later that day, under the cherry, oak, and sweet gum trees that punctuated our backyard, my father taught me to fly cast. He showed me the basics. Then, as is his fashion, left me to fail again and fail better every time I cast that yarn at a certain sweet gum leaf some 20 feet away. I was antsy and aggravated, ready to tie on a fly and go fishing. He simply said, "No, you're not ready." And that was my first lesson. Fly fishing, if anything, encourages the long labor of learning to patient the mind. Practice, work, discipline, skill, art. Yes, before anything artistic occurs, there are countless hours spent in practice. These are the steps to becoming proficient at fly fishing. Well, those cover the technical requirements anyway. One must also develop a body of knowledge that includes learning what fish live where, what they are eating at any given time, how to read water and weather patterns, proper line weight, appropriate tackle, etc. Norman McLean in A River Runs Through It says his father, Reverend McLean, insisted that in a perfect world, no one who did not know how to fish would be allowed to disgrace a fish by catching him. He also notes at length that fly fishing is an art and that art does not come easy. It is fairly impossible to try it, want to excel at it, yet not realize these things are true. It is not the simple task of hooking a worm and tossing it into likely water. Fly fishing both demands and allows the body to come into harmony with your thoughts, desires, and the world around you as you work towards one singular purpose, to fool a fish. Sounds silly, but it isn't. It doesn't take too much of a romantic to see the art in such an ecosystem. A watershed lake thrums with biodiversity. Snakes, frogs, insects, fish, humans, each connected to the other in a divine economy of violence and peace, of song and noise and quiet. Blustery wind, perfect stillness, it sings, it sways, it thumps, almost as though God is wrestling with what he's created. In the center is a man wrestling a big bass and his own conscience regarding its fate. He wants to land it. He wants to show it off. A part of him convinces another part of him he actually wants to eat it. Latent pride, justified by taste, hardly. Crappie are, of course, another matter. These lakes are holy fonts writ large, stoops of water where 1,000 kelsons of creation are evident every second. They are a microcosm of God's will. On display, ample opportunity to exercise his greatest hope, mercy. We see our own place in it, replete with choices we also must make. The Creator's imagination beheld a perfect context, water, a hook, a line, hope. Here I'm reminded every moment it is up to each of us to decide if we will prove him correct. Work, practice, discipline, skill, art. Also mercy, employed towards its highest purpose. This is the only way to become a fly fisherman. At some point, it becomes the place you occupy as one. And yet for years I suffered from clumsiness. While my father fished, I untied knots, dislodged hooks, or fumbled around with gear while trying to tell him a story. From time to time, Daddy would say, "Hold on, son, I need to catch this fish." Inevitably, there would be one headed to the net. Whenever he hooked one that splashed around the surface in protest, he would throw his head back and yell in pure joy, "Speak!" The noise of the fight would persist until he brought it to hand, more often than not, towards a show of tender clemency released back into the water. They say a human is 60% water, which seems like a lot. Some evolutionary biologists believe life itself emanated from water. Verily, man's earliest ground-bound predecessors crawled out of the ooze of a primordial swamp in some amphibious form, before spending the next 350 million years developing into the beautiful, fumbling, imperfect, hopeful creatures we are today. Ever seen a bass hit a frog pattern on a fly line? It's violent, archaic, primal. Perhaps the joy we feel catching fish, that innate urge we have to pursue them, emanates from a genetically encoded primogenial revenge mechanism in return for our primeval ancestors being fish food. But our fascination with fishing isn't confined to evolutionary science. In the Bible, Christ himself is a master angler, as were seven of the apostles whom he enjoined, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Among the first to answer his call is James, who teaches us that action is where thought marries belief and redemption is born. Though Reverend McLean insists that James' brother John is the favorite and a dry fly fisherman, I'm reminded, a la Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2, the reference to the beloved disciple occurs nowhere except in the book of John itself. For an angler taking an angler's advice, I say James, writing about love and action, had it in the net. As did Granddaddy, who loved a big smile and had a big laugh whenever the opportunity for a good laugh presented itself, and a fish to drop in the grease whenever one felt wanton enough to strike. As does my father, whom I see in a still frame of animated exuberance when playing a good fish, like the image of Christ ambling across the water's surface, suspended, unsinkable. I think also of his father's old split cane bamboo rod and the times he must have had with it. I am grateful for him and Mr. Mavis and Mr. Shook for wanting to improve their land, thus building these lakes. At times, casting flies here late in the evening, after the whirling abode of tanager, frog, croak, and grosbeak, when all movement ceases, a high breeze sighs across rippling water, and these three I recall: the moments, the lessons, these men. Whatever else has been lost, here I am at peace.